This week, we have an Empire State of Mind. From NPR, this is Trump's Trials. I'm Scott Detrow.
We love Trump!
This is a persecution.
He actually just stormed out of the courtroom.
Innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
As we have discussed, the New York hush money trial is not days away from beginning. It is on pause for at least a month. But still, today we are going to focus on New York because upcoming hearings and financial deadlines there will play a big role in determining what comes next for Donald Trump as he runs for president again. Early next week, a judge will determine what comes next in this trial. So we're going to review what this case is about and how those 34 felony counts could play politically. Remember, this is about hush money payments and the final days of the 2016 election. And then there's this massive payment looming. Trump needs to come up with nearly $500 million tied to that civil case about business fraud. His lawyers say they can't secure the bond. And if Trump cannot pay in the coming days, New York State could start seizing some of his assets. So New York is the focus today. And luckily for all of us, that gives Domenico Montanaro yet another opportunity to remind us all that he, just like Donald Trump, is from Queens.
In that concrete jungle where dreams are made of, Scott.
Let's go back, as much as we love to always do, to the final days of the 2016 presidential election. A great time in our lives, great time in everybody's lives. This case is all about alleged hush money payments made in that period of time, which meant that voters were kept in the dark about this alleged sexual relationship that Trump had as voters made their final choices in 2016. Now we know about it. We've known about it through 60 Minutes. We've known about it through congressional hearings. We've known about it through all sorts of news reports. And now this upcoming criminal trial. Any sense of what voters will make of all of these details now as they get hashed out in a criminal courtroom?
Well, polling has shown pretty consistently that majorities think that Trump did something wrong. I mean, whether that's illegal or just unethical. And this week we had a new poll out that found what other polls have found, which is that majorities of independents think that Trump is guilty of the crimes that he's been accused of. And significant percentages of them would not back him in a general election if he's found guilty. You know, those people would also like to see a trial and a determination by a jury of his peers as to his guilt or innocence before the election. But Trump's team continues to score victories in trying to delay these cases.
And as we hang out in one of those delays right now and wait for some upcoming key deadlines and hearings early next week, we're going to take this time to refresh some of the key facts in this criminal case and also with these big hundreds of millions of dollars in payments that are looming. Stick around. We will do that along with constitutional law expert Kim Whaley after a quick break. We are back, and we're joined by University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley. Kim, thanks for being back with us.
Great to be here.
I want to zoom out in a moment with this New York case, but first let's start with this delay, because that was in the news last week. There's going to be this hearing about it on Monday. The Southern District of New York, that's the federal prosecutors, they handed over thousands of documents related to this case, and they are still providing documents. Now, Manhattan's District Attorney Alvin Bragg said that due to this late dump of documents, it made sense to give a little bit of a pause for Trump's legal team to review this. What is going on here? Can you explain kind of the back and forth and why these documents would be coming at such a late stage?
Trump asked for these documents independently of Alvin Bragg, and DOJ didn't produce them until recently, and there are a lot of them, at least in number, 100,000 or so. One of the explanations, apparently, is that some of the documents, known as witness statements or 302s, the FBI calls them, weren't actually created until December. And so the Southern District just didn't have some of the documents to give Donald Trump until recently. Now, I know we're going to talk a little bit more about, the underlying charges that Alvin Bragg's office brought, but the relationship here is Michael Cohen. Donald Trump's former lawyer and fixer was investigated and pleaded guilty to election-related crimes to the Southern District of New York. So essentially, this bunch of documents relates to the Michael Cohen federal case. But because Michael Cohen will probably testify in the Alvin Bragg local criminal case, that is why there's some overlap here.
But
Bragg said, I think, just this week in a filing. There's only a couple, a few hundred of these documents that are relevant to the prosecution, his prosecution, and most of them help, according to Bragg, the government, not Trump. So I don't think this is going to derail things the way we've talked about in some of the other criminal cases pending against Trump. There's been some significant delays. I don't think that'll happen here.
So for the benefit of people listening who kind of hazily remember Michael Cohen testifying before Congress, and that might be the extent of things, can you catch us up on what this case is about? Because delay or not, we are almost certain this is going to be the first criminal case in all of the cases we're talking about. What's the gist of this case?
The gist of this case has to do with the adult film star, Stormy Daniels, who in the weeks leading up to the 2016 election, before the first time Trump ran for office in October, was paid $130,000 by Michael Cohen to basically not go public about her alleged sexual relationship with Donald Trump. The question in the federal case against Michael Cohen, among others, was whether that amounted to a violation of the criminal parts of the federal election laws, on the theory that if you are making contributions or expenditures in a campaign, you're spending money to help a candidate get elected, that needs to be disclosed under the federal campaign and election laws. And that the failure to disclose that constituted in Michael Cohen's case, among with other charges, a crime. He pleaded guilty to those charges.
Cohen did.
But because that wasn't a jury verdict, that doesn't really stand as, a precedent that is binding. And the theory, even against Cohen, that is the idea that hush money payments, which on their own are not illegal, separately constitute a campaign violation. Some people disagree on whether that's a legitimate legal theory. But all that being said, the Cohen case, he did plead guilty. So Alvin Bragg is essentially, and we can untangle this, but essentially using that same theory to prosecute Donald Trump under New York law, not under federal law.
And then there's the business filing side of this, in that Trump repaid Cohen, making it seem like they were legal payments. So there's fraud aspects of this as well.
Well, that's kind of the second layer. So what Bragg indicted Trump for was falsification of business records, which in New York is a misdemeanor. The way to pump that up to a felony is to say you falsified business records to essentially cover up some other crime. The other crime is the Stormy Daniels payoff to avoid it affecting his election chances in 2016. So falsification of business records is routinely charged in New York, but it's usually charged in connection with other crimes, kind of an add-on thing. Here, it's the only thing. It's the only thing that's been charged against Trump is this falsification of business records. And the way that Bragg got it from a misdemeanor to a felony is to tack on the argument that the reason Michael Cohen papered this $130,000 payout as essentially attorney's fees in various documents was to cover up the payoff to help the election. But yeah, the falsification was the paper trail that suggested that this was just payment of attorney's fees when really it was reimbursement to Michael Cohen for paying off Stormy Daniels so Stormy Daniels wouldn't go public about her affair with Donald Trump just literally weeks before November 4th of 2016.
And Kim, I want to come back to you on this, but I want to go to Domenico on this because that is the political crux of this, that you have Trump and his allies saying that this is a political case, that this is not something that would have been prosecuted, certainly not at a felony level in any other setting. This was about kind of going back and seeing, let's find something to bring a case against Donald Trump with. That is what you hear over and over again. And then the flip side is this argument from Alvin Bragg that this is something that could have affected the outcome of the election. I mean, what do you make of that framing on either side?
Well, and we have to remember when we think about why the Southern District of New York might have documents related to this case, it's because there was a potential crime committed when it comes to campaign finance law. Mm-hmm. So they were looking into this because in the summer of 2016 and then toward October of 2016, when a payment was eventually made to Stormy Daniels, as well as to Karen McDougal, the former Playboy playmate, in this quote-unquote catch-and-kill effort from National Enquirer, where essentially she sold her story to the National Enquirer. The Trump people pay the National Enquirer $150,000.
So they're never going to run it.
So that they don't run the story, yeah. Right. And remember, in the context of that time period, I mean, we had almost two dozen women accuse Trump of sexual misconduct.
Yeah.
And at the time in October of 2016, you had the Access Hollywood tape that came out where Trump is talking about the things he would do with women, to put politely, because we can't talk about exactly how they talked about that in that recording.
And in the moment, everyone thought that was the end of his campaign.
Yeah. And imagine if you had this on top of that. You know, I think that there would be a little bit more sort of piled on. It's just one of those things. It's just tawdry. It's another aspect of Trump's conduct. It's clearly before he was president, obviously. But all of these cases, like we've talked about before, you know, you're talking about conduct before, during, and after he was president for all four of these criminal cases. And then, of course, there's the civil cases where now we see Trump owing New York $500 million.
And we're going to get into those in detail in a few minutes. But Kim, obviously, prosecutors always make choices. What's fair and what's not fair when it comes to the way that Bragg's actions are being framed, whether or not it's a political case?
Well, Donald Trump filed a motion to dismiss the indictment, raising a number of arguments, including selective prosecution, that he was somehow being singled out. And that's a very high standard to satisfy, and it was rejected. So just from a legal standpoint, you know, the question is whether Bragg's team can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these crimes occurred and persuade the jury of this kind of complex, sort of a tortured fact pattern. It's definitely a difficult narrative for people to get their minds around. But I don't think, and to your point, you know, police officers decide, you know, they'll sit behind the bushes and they don't pull everybody over. They only pull certain people over. And, you know, Donald Trump has thrust himself into the national spotlight and is now on his third attempt to secure, you know, really unparalleled power. So to say that it's political, yeah, it's political in part because of what his posture is. And I think the position of the Manhattan DA is that, you know, and I tend to agree with this, is that, you know, people that are in power or seeking power, they probably should have a little more scrutiny, not less scrutiny, because the abuses of power are a problem than sort of just, you know, Joe Schmendrick on the street.
It's funny, related to this, right? Because Trump will say, if I wasn't running for president, none of this would be happening. And in some respects, that's true.
Because he wouldn't have been filing a campaign finance report.
Well, because also, when you run for president, there's a whole lot more scrutiny that comes regardless. And we're not talking about legal scrutiny necessarily, but when you talk about, you know, people looking into your life, your past behavior, and then there's a lot more people who want to come out of the woodwork to maybe sell their story to somebody to say, hey, this guy that's getting so much attention, let me tell you this, this thing that happened between us.
Yeah.
And then prosecutors start to see whether or not these things violate laws. And yeah, he probably wouldn't be getting the kind of attention and the kind of scrutiny that he's getting if he weren't running for president. But it doesn't mean that it's that he didn't do what he's being accused of.
I mean, think about Paula Jones, right? I mean, she came out about alleged sexual harassment when Bill Clinton was president. The case was unfolding while I was president, but it was about his time as an Arkansas governor. And long story short, that produced the impeachment process while he was president. So that had tremendous political fallout for him, you know, and maybe, maybe not, she wouldn't have come out if he was had just kind of gone off into the sunset as a private citizen. So we've seen this before. Donald Trump is not somehow, you know, victimized in ways that other politicians, you know, can say they have not been in the same level of scrutiny.
All right, let's talk about those $454 million now. That is the penalty plus interest due on Monday. Trump and his team have said that he has not been able to secure a bond. He did just make a lot of money merging his Truth social network, but he's not allowed to touch that money for several months, so that won't help here. Okay, so Kim, assuming Donald Trump does not come up with about $500 million in the next few days, What happens next? Why is the timing so important for Trump right now here?
Well, Trump needs to, under New York law, secure a bond in order to avoid having to pay the full judgment during an appeal. He can appeal, but without the bond or without putting in some kind of escrow the full amount of the judgment, he has to actually pay up pending resolution of the appeal. So this process is about being able to basically put everything on hold while he asks the appeals court in New York to reverse the underlying judgment.
And Domenico, we had a moment of Trump, the candidate and political figure, kind of undermining his own legal team, where his lawyers claimed in a filing he doesn't have the cash, he's having a hard time coming up with bonds. And then he posts on his social media platform, through hard work, talent, and luck, I currently have almost $500 million in cash.
Same.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's through hard work, sometimes it's not. But, you know, I mean, the fact is Trump also has this merger and public offering for Truth Social, which he claims is could be worth some $3.5 billion, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, is more than all of what he's apparently worth, according to Forbes.
But Kim, he's claiming, his team is claiming they can't come up with money, they can't come up with a bond. You know, there's certainly a long history of him not paying people back when they loan him money. So you can see why he might have a hard time finding $500 million. But what happens next? Does the state scrutinize whether they're telling the truth when it comes to that? Do they look at seizing properties? Like, how does this generally work?
If this were to move forward, you know, Letitia James could, you know, start getting law enforcement to start seizing assets. And, you know, this isn't my you know, Domenico would know more about this, but politically, that might be good for Trump to have, you know, TV footage of James trying to get, you know, the judgment actually enforced with money. I mean, a judgment's just a piece of paper. It's only so good as someone actually is willing to pay up. So that's essentially the step she would take. And given he has properties all over the world with complex holdings, it could be a mess to untangle.
Domenico, do you think that's true?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that we've talked a lot before about how Trump is viewed very differently among Republicans mm-hmm. as he is among independents in a general election. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that, you know, he can continue to say that he can raise money because he can claim victimhood and look, it's on TV, they're coming after my properties. At the same time, if this is spotlighted, it's on camera, people then are renewing an interest and asking questions about why is the state of New York, for example, going and trying to seize something that looks like Versailles in his Seven Springs estate in Westchester County, New York. You know, there could also be a class warfare argument that Democrats can make about how Trump is rightfully getting what he deserves. You know, people are so dug in. It's like we're fighting World War I sort of trench warfare when it comes to views of Trump, because, you know, we're going to have a very long general election here, 7.5 months to go until this election. And you're really talking about moving people at the margins.
Yeah. Yeah, and just we've a lot of attention on that those Westchester County estates. James has talked a lot about 40 Wall Street, his Lower Manhattan property, other options as well. And just to fill it out, I mean, Elise Stefanik, who's a key ally these days of Donald Trump in Congress and somebody who seems to be on the shortlist for vice president, puts out a statement the other day saying the weaponization against Joe Biden's political opponent, President Donald Trump, is an absolutely unprecedented form of election interference. It is fundamentally un-American, it goes on. So, like, that's how these possible seizures would be framed. It was a little bit of a holding pattern week, but I'll still end it with a question that we end each episode with. And, Kim, I'll start with you. Did you see anything that happened this week that could fundamentally change either these criminal cases or the presidential election?
Well, we didn't get a chance to talk about Mar-a-Lago. But the rulings that are happening down there with Judge Eileen Cannon relating to whether the Espionage Act is a legitimate charge, one of the charges in that case.
This is the documents case.
And the Double Jeopardy Clause, that could end up killing that case, yes.
Yes, we've focused on that lately. We will certainly come back to that very soon. That is a good point. A lot of questions about what Judge Cannon is doing and how she is thinking about this case. Domenico, what about you?
Well, I really think that this idea of what gets seized, if anything gets seized, is the thing that I'm really paying attention to, because I do think that there is something to the imagery of having an attorney general going and seizing properties, if that's the case, and Trump having his back against the wall. And we know when Trump has his back against the wall, he's not somebody who cowers. He's somebody who sort of fires back.
Or so, flails.
Right. And what does that mean, right? Because politically, that'll certainly have lots and lots of ramifications, like a snowball sort of going downhill. I'm really looking to see how that winds up playing out and, you know, whether or not there winds up being a case that starts in late April, as we kind of expect.
Yeah. That's senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also joined by Kim Whaley, constitutional law expert from the University of Baltimore. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week with another episode of Trump's Trials. Thanks to our supporters who hear the show sponsor-free. If that is not you, still could be. You can sign up at plus.npr.org or subscribe on our show page at Apple Podcasts. This show is produced by Tyler Bartlam and edited by Adam Rainey, Krishnadev Kalamar, and Steve Drummond. Our executive producers are Beth Donovan and Sam Yenigan. Eric Maripodi is NPR's Vice President of News Programming. I'm Scott Detrow. Thanks for listening to Trump's Trials from NPR.